Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, actors Dan Hyatt and Michael Stevenson, along with director Josh Costello, shared details about the witty play Wittenberg at the Aurora Theater. Sherry Greenewald, the director of the San Francisco Opera Center, talks about the upcoming Schwabacher recital involving singers from the Marilla Opera Program and some Adler Fellows. And conductor laureate of the San Francisco Symphony, Herbert Blumstedt, talks about his return to the podium for some special upcoming concerts. Stay with us. It's an honor and a pleasure to welcome my first guest. From 1985 to 95, Herbert Blumstedt was music director of the San Francisco Symphony, for which he is now conductor laureate, and returns for concerts next week and the following for works of Schubert and Nielsen in the first week and Mozart and Bruckner for the second. Under Maestro Blumstedt's leadership, the symphony was awarded its first Grammy Award for Carmina Burana by Carl Orff. That award, visible with the many other subsequent Grammys in the now very crowded display case that you can see in the lobby of Davies Symphony Hall. After leaving the San Francisco Symphony, he held principal conductorships with the North German Radio Symphony, Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. He's currently honorary conductor of the Bamberg Symphony, the Danish National Symphony, NHK Symphony, Swedish Radio Symphony, and Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. And this Monday, to coincide with the maestro's official return to San Francisco, the Decca Classics label will release a limited edition 15-CD collection entitled Herbert Blumstedt, The San Francisco Years, featuring a selection of the conductor's greatest San Francisco Symphony recordings, some of which have not been available for some time. Maestro Blumstedt, such an honor to welcome you to KLW.
Nice to be here again.
I'm a bit nervous because not only am I wowed by your abilities on the podium, you are also the first knight I've ever interviewed. You you received the Knight of the North Star from Stockholm and were dubbed a Knight of the Danebrogen in Copenhagen in 2008. So I'm happily you're wielding a baton and not a sword in this case for this interview. Now, you and the San Francisco Symphony received the Grand Prix du Disque for your recording of Nielsen's Third and Fourth Symphonies, now bringing back the Nielsen Clarinet Concerto to Davies Hall, which marks only the second time the orchestra has performed the work. The first time the San Francisco did this was back in 1989 with Richard Stoltzman as guest soloist, also with you at the podium. Talk to me about your special connection to Danish composer Carl Nielsen.
Well, he's certainly the greatest Danish composer ever. And they have had quite a few wonderful, great composers. So that means something. He was a contemporary, exact contemporary of Jean Sibelius, the Finnish symphonist. And both are mainly symphonists. A great command of the symphony as a form and the knowledge of the orchestra. It just sounds terrific. And it's very strong music, very masculine music, but also very sensitive, extremely beautiful, with small means often. The Clarinet Concerto is one of his latest works. Usually only a small orchestra with only four winds and a small string orchestra, and very important, a snare drum who interrupts the proceedings quite dramatically. As typical Carl Nielsen, perhaps a little bit of a boyish protest there. Concerto was written for a friend of his, a real character, a very warm person, but he was also a choleric. He could have enormous explosions. You can hear that in the concerto. It is written for him and exposes the clarinet in all its registers.
Now, the second and third symphonies of Nielsen are represented on this massive release, the 15 set CDs coming out on Decca. And these recordings are still considered by aficionados and critics alike as seminal recordings that are the standard for Nielsen. You must have a very special personal relationship with bringing that music to life.
Of course, I was a music director in Copenhagen for 10 years, so I imbued the Danish spirit. But it was also music that I was touched by very early in my student years. The first time I ever held a viola in my hand, I was a violinist, but the first time I held a viola in my hand, it was playing a string quartet by Carl Nielsen. An early quartet, the G minor, wonderful music. I still have it in my head today. It's a wonderful, wonderful music. I love it, and I wish it would be better known.
And the clarinet concerto will be performed on these performances with principal clarinetist Carrie Bell of the San Francisco Symphony. Have you worked with Carrie much?
Yes, he's been the principal clarinet of the orchestra for a few years. He's a wonderful, wonderful soloist. I'm looking forward very much to do this with him. And I think he's looking forward to doing it with us. You said it was the second time when we played the concerto for the symphony. That's quite remarkable. It's among clarinetists, it's considered one of the two great clarinet concertos, Mozart and Nielsen. It certainly shows the instrument from another side of Mozart, but equally great compositions. I'm very glad to do it with him, and hope they will do it many times afterwards.
And you're pairing this, the Nielsen Clarinet Concerto, with Schubert's the Great Symphony, and it's called the Great for so many reasons. It's a marvelous piece of music, the Ninth Symphony of Schubert, for which you recorded all nine of the symphonies with the Dresden, was it? So what was the particular pairing thoughts behind the Nielsen and the Schubert?
Well, it's above all, it's a great contrast. But the Nielsen concerto also is a great singing concerto. It is wild some places, and perhaps remembered mostly for its wild passages. But there are lots of marvelous lyrics there. And Nielsen was a great song composer. He composed 300 songs that are not so much known. And they are models of simplicity, at the same time unforgettable. That's really the sign of a great composer, that he can write simple and still attain greatness. Mm-hmm. To be simple is no problem if you just want to have a few notes, but to be simple and great at the same time, only a great composer can do that. Like Schubert, and like Nielsen.
Now, I mentioned you recorded the Schuberts with a European orchestra, the Dresden Staatskapelle, and I'm wondering if you can tell the contrast between an American orchestra playing Schubert, and you mentioned that your time in Copenhagen kind of had Nielsen wear off on you, and you've spoken about the unique relationship of major cities of the world with their primary symphony orchestras. Now, if you were plopped down magically onto some podium, not knowing where you were going, within a few bars could you say, oh, here I am in Vienna, or here I am in Boston? What are those distinctions that make orchestras?
Well, they are very delicate. It's not easy to put in words. But Dresden Orchestra has a very special tradition. They have the musicians of the Dresden Orchestra, mostly often they came from Dresden itself, from the same city, which is a small city, 500,000. And of course, at the time of Schubert, it was only, I guess, 100,000 at the maximum. They trained their own musicians to keep their own tradition alive. The Schubert of this symphony is, of course, a grand Schubert. He had strived all his life to write something symphonic grand. He had written, you know, 7 symphonies before, but they're all rather on a small, intimate scale. that was Schubert's real medium, to the short utterance, a short song, you know, 5 minutes. He could say something great. But he admired Beethoven. He wanted to be like Beethoven, but he knew he couldn't. He tried. He followed Beethoven, you know, at the distance of 50 feet behind him just to have looks at him. He admired him enormously. In his late chamber music, he attained some of the greatness of Beethoven also, not only his intimate, wonderful, deep lyricism, but in this symphony, for the first time, he achieved a great symphony on the grand scale of Beethoven, without imitating Beethoven. He's fully Schubert. I think one of the reasons why he abandoned the Seventh Symphony, the unfinished symphony, was that he wanted to be like Beethoven, but he couldn't. Here he could. And so he completed this symphony on a grand scale. It's really an enormous scale. It's different between a small country and a big country. There's a difference between the state of Rhode Island and the enormous vastness of the United States.
Hmm. Now, the second set of concerts will be pairing Anton Bruckner with some Mozart. Now, what about your relationship with Anton Bruckner?
I love Bruckner. For the first time I heard him, I was a 13-year-old boy. It was music that opened up to completely new sound vistas. It was serene, and it was very dramatic, grand. At the same time, it was very intimate, very much like Schubert, wonderful melodies, very Viennese in many respects. You can hear it every other bar. But at the same time, it is such on a grand scale. The themes are expansive. Only if it, oh, it's... Even if it's only a few notes, the theme of the first movement. Rest. Rest. The second group was only one note difference, but what a difference! It's a completely new sky, new horizons, with one change of one note. It's remarkable. Hmm.
And you're pairing this, the Bruckner Fourth, which I should mention is also on the set of Decca releases that's coming out on Monday. You're performing the Bruckner Fourth with Mozart, with Garrick Olson, who you've collaborated with for over 30 years, I believe. Now, was the Mozart 21st concerto chosen for a particular reason for
no,
to go?
No, that was Garrick Olson's choice.
There you go, okay.
And all the Mozart concertos are wonderful. You could take anyone. It's a good pairing with Bruckner. It's both Viennese, but different aspects of Vienna. The work that you pair with Bruckner should not be on such a grand scale. It would not fare well compared then with Bruckner. Mozart's music is not small in Konzerten. It's great music, but the orchestra he uses is rather small. And what he says, he does with wonderful means. So it's a good contrast also to Bruckner.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Herbert Blomstedt, who's returning to the podium of the San Francisco Symphony as conductor laureate for some concerts April 3rd to 11th. The last 3 years or so of your tenure at San Francisco Symphony saw the fruition of some acoustic renovations at Davies Symphony Hall. Now, were the deficiencies of the new hall noticeable from the start, or from that matter, from your perspective on the podium?
Oh, yes. It was a good hall, but it was not perfect. All very big halls, and Dave Symphony is a big hall, large hall, are tricky because they are so long distance to the walls, which makes the reflecting sounds come later. And not so strong. So, with the expert acoustician and help of the architect, we narrowed the hall a little bit, without changing it very much, and the acoustics became very much better. I remember at the same time Carnegie Hall had some acoustical changes. They were minor compared to ours, but their changes did not really improve the hall. It was not so good anymore. But our hall was way better. So after the renovation, we were, of course, very proud and very happy that it turned out like that. And our hall, I thought, was even better than Carnegie Hall acoustically. I enjoy playing very much in Davies, and the orchestra, of course, it's their hall. They have adapted their sound to the possibilities of the hall. It's a great combination.
Mm-hmm. Now, I imagine this Decca box set that's coming out, 15 CDs called Herbert Blomstedt, the San Francisco years, San Francisco Symphony years. I imagine that both halls are reflected in those recordings. Can we, as a listener to those CDs, know the approximate year by listening to these recordings?
Possibly, yes. I never thought about that. Of course, the orchestra is the same, and I'm the same, but we all change very subtly, even from day to day. But I think there's a common denominator there, and the discs, I think, will be a good reminder of a great decade.
Well, you've written that you don't enjoy listening to your own recordings very much. I'm wondering, was this 15 CD project difficult for you?
No, I didn't listen to them. I didn't make the choice.
Oh, so it was all Decca's choice.
It's Decca's choice. Why I react negatively is often why I notice only the mistakes, only the deficiencies, because nothing is perfect. Even what you enjoy, wonderfully enjoy and are grateful for, when you look at it with magnifying glasses.
You may be listening and say, why didn't I bring this out? Why didn't I bring that passage out?
I would like to do this differently. I wish he or she would have done that a little bit more like that. And to notice, to make a list of deficiencies is not very rewarding. But that is what we have to do, of course, when we listen, what we have done and want to proceed with the recording. We have to correct something that we are not satisfied with. But the end result, of course, we are grateful for that. And the end result in these recordings was great. The collaboration also with the Decca engineers was wonderful. The producer, Andrew Cornell, was producer, I think, for all these recordings. He was a find for us. He contributed his vision of the sound with our vision, and it was a wonderful mixture.
You have some different arrangements of the orchestra when you conduct the strings in different places. Is that your own choice, or is that dictated by the repertoire that you might be choosing?
It's dictated by the composers. Mm. These recording, I would say, unfortunately, the one thing that I am not so happy with is made in the modern American seating, with cellos and basses to the right of the conductor. But the composers, all the composers of these recordings, all without exception, wrote for an orchestra where the second violins were right, opposing the first violins. Hmm. And you get even more clarity that way. You get more of a dialogue between the first and second
one. And more of a center of the orchestra coming at you, too.
And the deep sounds comes not from the right edge, it's from the depth of the orchestra, where they should come from. So it's not my choice. It's what the composers intended. And we are happy to, in our concerts that we do nowadays, since 1995, I always have this seating also when I come back to San Francisco.
Well, it's safe to say now that approaching age 87, you've experienced the full range of recording media in your lifetime. You were already 21 years old when the first LPs came out, after all. Now, I'm wondering how that might have changed your own music education. Do you consider now the best of times in this digital world, or do you find that there are younger people that don't appreciate the wax and the vinyl that you studied with early?
I think the sound visions of our engineers in the 80s and 90s were just as profound as today. And the technical equipment they had was also great. What considers me today, mostly, especially in the radio, is that the sound is comprimated. So the difference between loud and soft is not so big as it is in the concert hall. But on the CDs, we can realize more of the full range of the orchestra playing. And this is, of course, what we work on very much, the difference between loud and soft. And also the small differences, not the big difference only between extremely loud and extremely soft, the small differences. And this is what makes the listening so rich and so exciting. But with good people in the recording studio, we can achieve wonderful results there. But it must not be streamlined for those only who sit in their cars and listen, but to those who have the great equipment to imitate the concert hall.
You bring to the podium your love of the Western canon of literature, music literature. I'm wondering if, in your opinion, what is going to be 100 years from now, 20th century composers that will become part of the repertoire, the survivors? And who do you enjoy conducting on the contemporary front?
Well, of course, I'm not the prophet. there can be many surprises. During my years in San Francisco, 10 years, we performed perhaps 25 world premieres together. I don't know how much of that will survive, but surely some it will. And I made some very surprising and very happy discoverings. Pieces I played or premiered, world premiere 50 years ago, and that have been completely forgotten. I picked up again, and they are just as fresh today as they were 50 years ago. So there is hope. I mean, exciting music that is exciting for today can perhaps be less exciting the coming 10 years, but they may be resurrected again. This is great news for the composers. I'm sure it's difficult for a composer to be at the forefront and receive much attention and then be forgotten. But there is time goes on, and this is one of the advantages of that there are recordings. You can pick it down from the shelf and get a new start.
Well, we have a wonderful legacy on the way on Monday with the Decca release of the 15 CD set from the Decca Classics, Herbert Blumstedt, the San Francisco years. Now, also safe to say that you're at a stage in life where you have the luxury to pick and choose projects now. What's on your bucket list? What do you still want to get accomplished, or an ensemble you still wish to pursue, or even a place you'd like to visit in these next few years?
Well, I'm very lucky to play every year with the greatest orchestras that we have around the globe. Not only the San Francisco Symphony, but also other great American symphonies. I play every year several concerts with the Vienna Philharmonic, with the Berlin Philharmonic, with the Concertgebouw. I heard just per chance the other day one of our concerts from the Concertgebouw a couple of months ago. I was fascinated by the sound, and it's wonderful. And also the orchestra of the Bayerischer Rundfunk in Munich is a fantastic orchestra. And of course I enjoy the relation with my old orchestras in Leipzig and Dresden. They sound absolutely great. And I enjoy this collaboration very much. I'm very spoiled. Of course the repertoire is getting a little bit smaller. I try to concentrate on the pieces I have loved most, and the new pieces that I have been most fascinating with. I play new music constantly, music that I've never played before, but also music that I always wanted to perform but I never had time to. A couple of months ago, I played for the first time a big symphony by Wilhelm Stenhammar, a Swedish composer, a little bit later than Nilsson and Sibelius, but a great friend of both and a great performer of both. his symphony, everybody has been telling me all my life, you must play that, you must play that. I never had the time. Then I went to Dresden, I had to play other music. Then I went to San Francisco, I had to play American music. Stenheim, I was always pushed aside. Finally, I was 86 when I did it first time, I get to play this music. It was great, absolutely great. And now play it with all the great orchestras around the world, with Dresden and with Leipzig, and we play it in San Francisco also. There are always discoveries to be made. This makes it exciting all the way.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, let me be one of the first to wish you a happy 87th birthday coming up in a few months, with many more to come. You're doing something right, that's for sure. I wish you success on the podium once again and your return to San Francisco here.
Thank you. This is a wonderful place.
Herbert Blomstedt returns to the San Francisco Symphony podium for concerts April 3rd to the 11th. Also coinciding with a 15-CD release on the Decca Classics label, Herbert Blomstedt, The San Francisco Years. Let's hear a part of a track, I wish we could play more, of the Schubert Ninth Symphony First Movement, reflected on those Decca recordings, and will be heard on Davies Symphony Hall next week. The future of opera is alive and well, thanks in large part to the good work and stewardship of my next guest. Sherry Greenewald is the director of the San Francisco Opera Center, which is dedicated to promoting the stars of our operatic future through the Marilla Opera Program and Adler Fellowships. For over 25 years, the center has always looked forward, recognizing, cultivating, and nurturing the finest talent available. And even before the establishment of the center, through the efforts of former opera director Kurt Adler, for whom the Adler Fellow Program gets its name. Past Adler Fellows and Marilla grads include top voices who have graced the stages of opera halls around the world, including Melody Moore, Patricia Racette, Ruth Ann Swenson, Deborah Voigt, Dolores Zajac, Noah Stewart, and Thomas Hampson, to name just a few. This Sunday, the Merula Opera program presents the second of three Schwabacher debut recitals, itself now in its 32nd season. The recital will be at Temple Emmanuel's Martin Meyer Sanctuary here in San Francisco at 5:30 in the afternoon. It's a pleasure to welcome Sherry Greenewald back to KLW to talk about that concert and about the Opera Center. Hi, Sherry.
Hello.
These are tough times for opera in this country. I was just reading about the thriving opera scene in Chicago, but the plot summary in recent years has unfolded rather like the last act of Tosca. New York City Opera dead, Opera Boston dead, and San Diego Opera perhaps on its final aria. But things here in San Francisco seem to be thriving, packing them in both to the Opera House and to the concert open-air concert hall that is AT&T Park and Golden Gate Park. So what are we doing right here?
Well, I think David's been great about programming. And
talking about David Gockley, the artistic director of San Francisco Opera.
Yes. And, you know, he's always been committed to bringing world premieres. And while maybe the box office isn't always exactly 100% for world premieres, that's very important to a company and energizes your base a little bit. And so I do think doing these works has been very important for our company as well. And he's, you know, bringing in as many stars as we can haul out here, you know, and having a vital music director like Maestro Luis Zotti is so critical as well. And, of course, we have a spectacular orchestra sitting in the pit, which really helps matters.
Yes, some dear colleagues and friends of mine are down there and certainly enjoy that. Now, how is the Opera Center then adapting to this changed landscape? And is this a changed landscape just in this country or is it being seen elsewhere in the world as well?
Well, it hit our business a little bit after the basic economic crisis back in 2008, right? So it's sort of, it's trickling down now. Talk about trickle-down economics. Now we're having it. So I think that is what's happening. Fortunately for me, because my company is stable, my work has been stable, and Merula has a very healthy endowment themselves, and so they have been able to weather these storms nicely, and it hasn't. The only sad thing for me is that I am seeing so much good talent come through, and then when the work begins to contract, as it has, they're having so much more difficulty finding places to enter the business because some of the companies that would be a natural place for them to come in have now disappeared. And so it's more difficult for the young artists.
Mm-hmm. Now, the parallel to training these young singers, I like to think of it as similar to training a professional athlete, whether it's a Jet, a Yankee, or a Giant. A mezzo, bass, or tenor also has a finite shelf life, and that career has to be guided fairly carefully. So what happens at the Opera Center other than singing?
Oh, you name it, we do it practically. I mean, we have media counseling. They have languages, of course. You know, we try to prepare them for whatever's coming down the track. We do sort of marketing seminars with them about when they leave the San Francisco Opera, they're going to be responsible basically for marketing themselves. And so helping them just figure out how to navigate even, let's say, the website to their advantage, you know, how to research, for instance, what a company may be doing in years ahead so that they can, if they go in for an audition in that company, they're targeting the right thing. Little details like that can make a difference.
Sure. For those listeners that may not be familiar with the Merula program and the Adler Fellowship, could you maybe in a nutshell tell us the larger umbrella that is the Merula Opera program?
Well, the Merula Opera program actually is its own program. It's a separate 501c3. And so they raise all their own funds themselves. And so they contract the San Francisco Opera to run the program artistically for them. And so that is how the relationship and the symbiosis comes about. And then the Opera Center is basically a San Francisco Opera department. We are just a department of the SFO. And so that's the differentiation. My staff also helps staff for Merula, and et cetera. So that's where we all join hands.
Certain degree of cooperation.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, on to the Schwabacher series. This middle of three recitals isn't just your average vocal recital. New York Festival of Song artistic director Stephen Blyer is involved. I'm wondering how he got involved in this concert.
Well, Stephen is an old friend of mine, and we even used to share a flat in New York together, if you can imagine. So we go way, way back. And Stephen has been part of this New York Festival of Song since its inception. And so I've sung with Stephen at the New York Festival of Song, for instance. We did a Russian program together. So I knew what kinds of programs Stephen could put together. And so we've just had him out. And he always puts together these inventive, unusual programs. For instance, I don't know how many formal song recitals will have Smokey Robinson on them, but we will.
Also some Stephen Sondheim on the
and
program,
some Stephen Sondheim, exactly.
So let's talk about this specific program, this middle concert happening this Sunday, March 30th, titled In the Memory Palace.
Right, which is taken from a song cycle that will have its West Coast premiere here by Gabe Kahane. And so the title for the recital was taken from that. And our very wonderful New Zealand-based baritone Hadley Adams will sing this song cycle. And it's a very personal, very contemporary language. Not so much so musically as, of course, the poetry itself is very, very contemporary subjects. And the music is lovely as well to accompany it and very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the title has come from.
Okay. And what else is on the program? You mentioned some Smokey Robinson and Stephen Sondheim.
Well, I've heard them rehearsing You've Got a Hold on Me.
Nice.
Which is a great Smokey Robinson song. And it's just amazing to hear, you know, these kids who I'm used to hearing Una Furtiva Lagrima coming out of their mouths. All of a sudden, you know, they're going, mm-ba, 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 mm-ba. You know, it's like, what? So it's
future training for Chanticleer, maybe.
Exactly. So, and Stephen always brings things like this. I remember one year we did the Beach Boys in My Room. And again, so he does fantastic arrangements. And so we're just very lucky.
These are billed as the Schwabacher debut recitals. How are the soloists chosen for this, and who's in the lineup for Sunday?
In the lineup this Sunday is all current Adler Fellows. And so we have the wonderful Maria Valdez, soprano. And we have Zanda Schwede, who is our Latvian mezzo. We have A.J. Glückert, who went to the San Francisco Conservatory, so he's sort of a local boy, if you will, as a tenor. And Hadley Adams, our New Zealander, singing in the lower ranges.
Very nice. And again, how were they chosen for this recital?
Well, for the Stephen Blyer recital, most often we people it almost exclusively with Adlers, just because it usually takes multiple singers for this recital. And so we usually, this helps us keep costs down, to tell you the total truth about it. But it's also because it takes so much rehearsal, it's easier as well because the Adlers are there. And so we can devote more hours to it in a way.
Mm-hmm. So at the Marilla Opera Program, how many students are involved at any one given? Is it arranged by semester, by year? How are things
with
organized?
Marilla is only a summer, 11-week summer training program. And the way it works for us is that all the Adler Fellows were in Marilla. So every Adler Fellow is a Marilini.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, Marilla, then they're happy to help sponsor these recitals because, of course, they're sponsoring Marilini still. So that's the good thing.
How many singers will be involved in a typical summer?
The summer, we have 23 singers. We have 5 pianists and 1 stage director.
Terrific.
Yes.
It's the Schwabacher debut recital, the middle of 3 recitals, this coming Sunday, March 30th at 5:30, entitled In the Memory Palace. Stephen Blyer will be directing, also playing piano, Maria Valdez, soprano, Zanda Schwede, mezzo-soprano, A.J. Glücker, tenor, and Hadley Adams, baritone. For information at this concert, which is going to be at Temple Emmanuel's Martin Meyer Sanctuary on Lake Street here in San Francisco, go to the San Francisco Opera website where you can learn more about the singers involved and more about the Marilla program itself. Sherry, I thank you so much for talking about this. I'm sure it's going to be a fantastic concert Sunday.
Okay, thank you.
Speaking of you, oh, you treat me badly. I love you, man.
Just a touch of Smokey Robinson for you that you can hear at the 2014 Schwabacher debut recitals at the Temple Emmanuel Martin Meyer Sanctuary this Sunday. Information, once again, at sfopera.com. To round things out on Open Air, Peter Robinson will be by to talk about the Intimate Impressions show at the Legion of Honor, plus a review of ACT's just-opened Venus in Furs. But my next guests are involved with the Aurora Theater Company presentation of the Bay Area premiere of Wittenberg, David Davalos' hilarious mashup about reason versus faith. Josh Costello is here. He's making his Aurora Theater Company main stage directing debut with Wittenberg. His extensive directing credits include the adaptation of Little Brother by Cory Doctorow for Custom Made Theater Company, Ideation by Aaron Loeb, and Reborning by Zaid Dorn at the San Francisco Playhouse, among other productions. And his adaptation of The Rover for the Chance Theater Company and Orange County aired as a live television broadcast on PBS in L.A. and Orange County. Josh is the literary manager at Aurora Theater. Welcome, Josh.
Hi.
Dan Hyatt, Bay Area favorite, appeared last season in Aurora's hit production of The Arsonists, for which he talked about on Open Air, returns as Martin Luther in Wittenberg. Dan was also in the recent productions of 1776 and Major Barbara, both winning productions at ACT, and Romeo and Juliet at California Shakespeare Theater. Veteran of the Aurora stage, he also performed during the company's inaugural Addison Street season in Knock Knock. Dan, welcome back.
Hi, David.
And Michael Stevenson is making his Aurora Theater Company debut as Faustus. His extensive credits include work up at the Capitol Stage Company, and he's also co-director of the B Street Theater Conservatory and a member of the B Street Theater Acting Company. He holds an MFA from ACT. Michael, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, this is being called, a tragical, comical, historical prequel to Hamlet. Who wants to start with that explanation?
I guess I'll jump in.
Josh.
It's a campus comedy, and it imagines what would happen if Hamlet, as an undergrad at Wittenberg, which is referred to in Shakespeare's play, it imagines what would happen if his professors happened to be Martin Luther, who was also at Wittenberg before he started the Protestant Reformation, and Dr. Faustus, who also has a Wittenberg connection before he made his famous deal with the devil.
So hilarity ensues. Is that safe to say, Dan Hyatt?
That usually happens. And I think the beauty of Wittenberg that Davalos has come up with is that it's a real comedy of character, putting these people together. And the little that I've read about Martin Luther so far.
Well, you need to do more homework.
I'll get right on it. But he has really captured a thumbnail sketch of this guy who's rigid, conflicted, severe on the outside, but inside there's this revolutionary dying to get out. He's, in a way, constipated, literally and figuratively. And Dr. Faustus comes in to really to help him find his way out of his personal dilemma. And I think it's these great characters coming together that really cause the sparks to fly and the comedy to happen, in addition to some wonderful one-liners. But
Michael Stevenson, you're playing Faustus. Tell us some of the arguments you make to our distinguished lead actor here, Martin Luther.
Well, we're both advising our student Hamlet, and we're trying to get him to choose our side, basically. And so I'm really about reason and thinking your way through and challenging authority. And so is Martin, in a way.
In a way.
Yeah, and so I'm trying to convince him to kind of broaden his mind and open up to the possibilities of reason and thinking his way through his famous dispute with the church, actually.
There's a character in Wittenberg called the Eternal Feminine. Josh, you want to take what is this character?
Sure. Well, that refers to one of the versions of the Dr. Faustus story. But in this play, David Davalos, the playwright in Wittenberg, has taken four female characters that appear in the play, and one actress is going to play all four of them. And Elizabeth Carter is doing a fantastic job bringing these characters to life. One of them is named Helen, which is a reference to Dr. Faustus bringing the soul of Helen of Troy to life in Marlowe's play, the face that launched 1,000 ships. And she's a really powerful character. All four of them are powerful in their own way and have a lot to say to the men in the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, we already kind of touched on Dan Hyatt's lack of historical research into Martin Luther. I'm wondering how you informed your character, Michael Faustus.
Well, it's interesting. I started by reading Christopher Marlowe's play. And then Faustus was a real guy, actually. There was a guy at Wittenberg called George Faustus who was an actual student at the time that Martin Luther was there. But then I started looking at Timothy Leary and our Faustus, our play is very anachronistic. There's a lot of crazy mix-up of the future and the present. And I'm kind of the free love, free thought kind of charismatic professor who's trying to open up people's minds. And, you know, and along the way, Martin, too. So I've been looking at a lot of people, like Mick Jagger is another guy I'm starting to look at. And just that guy in college who just like cracked on your head and said, okay, but what about this?
Josh Costello, as director, how do you strike the balance between these characters that are going on as a director?
How do I strike the balance? Well, it's the play does a lot of that work for me. The play, you know, puts them in conflict, but it also does a great job of showing that these guys are friends all the way through it. It's one of the remarkable things about the play is that it's filled with drama and with conflict between them, but they're always trying to help each other out. They think if only this guy would see what I see, he would just agree with me, and that they're always striving to get the other one to agree, but it's coming from a place of love and respect, and their friendship ultimately becomes what's threatened at the center of the play. What's at stake for the play, for all three of them, for Hamlet and for the two professors, is that they really love each other, they really care about each other, and if they can't figure this out and solve this problem, they're going to lose their friendship. And they ultimately take some actions to get what they want and to go after their way of looking at the world that does threaten the friendship that they have.
Mm-hmm. This play seems to be very popular, given the number of productions since 2008, even in Germany, Switzerland, the UK, Australia even. Now, what makes it such a good play? Where is Davalos' strength as a playwright?
Here's the thing. I think it's, you know, he's done all this historical research. He's come up with this very, very clever, witty way of putting these three characters together. But at the bottom of it, there's a real story there. And if you don't know anything about Hamlet, or you don't know anything about Luther, you don't know anything about Faustus, you know, it's not going to matter. If you do know, there are all kinds of Easter eggs sprinkled through the script that will be a lot of fun to catch. But if you don't catch all those Easter eggs, you still have a really compelling story about these people.
Talk to me about the set. What are we going to see on the Aurora stage?
I love the set. Erickson Conan, I've worked with him before. He's the scenic designer, and he's done a fantastic job. You're going to see the church doors at Wittenberg, where Luther famously posted his 95 Theses and started the Protestant Reformation. You're going to see what was really fun about this is looking at the way that this really is a campus comedy. And, you know, Aurora Theater is right near UC Berkeley, and I've spent a lot of time walking around that campus. And one of the things you always notice walking around Cal is all of the flyers posted everywhere on Sproul Plaza. And at the beginning of the play, the script calls for, you know, we see somebody hammering a flyer onto the church door that's already covered with flyers. And so we really looked at Sproul Plaza as research for a set design for Wittenberg.
Very nice. Very nice. And gentlemen, what other challenges are you facing? Not getting in each other's way in this play? Is it that kind of a fast pace?
Yeah, it you know, it is really fast paced, and I think keeping a straight face seems to be a problem for some of us in these rehearsals so far.
You don't want to go all Harvey Korman, Tim Conway kind of like.
we may not have a choice actually.
I would say too. You know, it's this extraordinary fusion because when talking about it, it sounds so intellectual, but it really plays like the Marx Brothers. It's just like so funny. It's literally one of my favorite plays. And he's fused this point in history, this extraordinary point where everything in the world is about to change. That Copernicus's revolution is about to happen. Luther's revolution is about to happen. The unified authority of the Catholic Church is about to be dissolved. There are an extraordinary scientific things coming about. Magellan's voyage is going to rock our concept of a flat world. But the thing is, the play itself is just tearful. tear-making funny. It is, it's Tom Stoppard meets the Marx Brothers. It's just so much fun to watch and so goofy and great ideas, but also in like pie-in-the-face kind of way.
Well, I look forward to it.
And you get the lute and song stylings of Michael Stevenson.
That's correct.
As Dr. Faustus.
Nice.
And a live tennis match.
Yes, that's correct. Right. This, live tennis.
Not to be missed. It opens opens officially April 10th. It's April 4th through May 4th. The play is Wittenberg. These gentlemen are involved with it. Dan Hyatt, thanks for coming in for this.
Thank you. Michael
Stevenson, Josh Costello.
Thanks. We're really excited. Aurora just announced our next season as well, 2014-2015. I'm directing Detroit by Lisa D'Amore. We've got a bunch of shows coming up that are going to be fantastic.
We'll have a preview of the full season down in a few weeks. We'll have someone out on to talk about that. Information about the shows at Aurora Theater, theater with an R-E, auroratheater.org. Once again, runs through May 10th, not to be missed. Wittenberg. Do catch it. Coming up, Peter Robinson and the conclusion of this week's Open Air. Stay with us. Our critic at large, Peter Robinson, joins us in studio once again with some art and acting on his mind. Hello, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And two very lively, different type of shows just opened in town this week. So I'm going to start with the first at ACT. It is called Venus in Fur, F-U-R in Fur. And this is definitely a rousing production. It's a two-hander. An intriguing story based, in fact, on a 1870 novel. And when I say it has something for everybody, I mean everybody here in New York, in San Francisco, in London, but probably not in Kansas. If you're into a play about cross-dressing, if you're into female domination, if you're into male domination, if you're into gender bending, if you're into a play within a play, then you're welcome to come to ACT this week. But it is a play for everybody if you live in San Francisco.
Well, I think it extends beyond those borders. I was there last night as well for the opening night. It's really a fun show and very thought-provoking. And it's 90 minutes, no intermission, so you don't have a large commitment at ACT, but find out information about tickets at act-sf.org.
And I think one of the key words, it's a phrase which is used frequently in the play, is ambiguity or ambivalence. And I think this is the playwright really leaving the audience to make their own judgment. So when you see the two characters who really are the background to the story, she arrives, her name is Wanda, for an audition. She arrives late, and the playwright, stroke adaptator and director, who is played by Henry Clark, is about to go home. And that's where the story begins. And the story takes you into many different stages of what does it mean to be an actor, what does it mean to be a director, and what does it mean to play out a fantasy which could turn into reality. One thing I would add about this production is it is, as David said, 90 minutes. There is no intermission. But I noticed that the difference between here and when I first saw it in New York, the actual repartee, the dialogue, was a bit snappier and faster. And I think sometimes on opening nights, the actors are still warming up. So I think probably we'll see that intriguing dialogue, and the words are well worth listening to speed up.
Interesting. Yeah, and you mentioned it's a two-hander. Each of those actors do have two hands, so I like to call them four-handers. Okay. Two of those hands belong to Henry Clark, and two of the other hands belong to Brenda Meaney, both tour de force performances.
They are very powerful performances. In fact, the audience gave them a standing ovation, which I think they well deserved. And I also think you feel by the end of this, where do you stand yourself? At one point in the play, the actress Brenda Meaney, playing Vanda, poses the question, and it is a question, although it's put in a statement, I am who I am. And as she stands and faces in a very intriguing outfit, you wonder exactly who is she? And I think that's part of what David Ives wants to do, engaging the audience, and this certainly engaged me from the very beginning. I then moved on to what has literally opened today, up at the Palace of the Legion of Honour. It is a new art exhibition called Intimate Impressionism. It comes from the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., and I think it's worth taking a second just to explain the title, Intimate Impressionism, because this is the collection from Mrs. Mellon. They've actually done the backdrop to these 68 paintings in a very neutral backdrop, as though you're actually in her own living room or living rooms in her apartment in New York. It is part of the bigger exhibition at the National Gallery. And it covers the years from 1860 to 1910. In other words, it is the full blast of Impressionism before Modernism takes over. And you will see intriguing works by Manet, by Degas, and it finishes up with Pierre Bonnard. So you're seeing how over 50 years the whole style of painting, particularly with the emphasis on the French school, began to develop and would finally come to a roaring stop when Impressionism finishes and the Age of Modernism begins. A couple of tips if you go into the exhibition. They certainly invite you to get close to the paintings because there you can see almost how the brushwork and how the actual painter achieved the incredible success. And I would certainly recommend reading the notes that go with them. It's a good example where the backup story can help you understand more about how these different painters began to see things in their own eyes differently. Funnily enough, I noticed a note in a journal from Henry James, who actually went in 1870 to the first set of these Impressionist exhibitions. And Henry James, who was no modernist, was also strangely curious and strangely critical of these paintings. And what he called decorative realism, I think today, you know, we consider this to be really the high watermark of painting. One rumour, for example, is given completely over to Renoir. There are eight different Renoirs in one room, and you see a full range of both the really portrait of the female, but also one of the few more landscapey type paintings that Renoir did. I think this is a truly, truly engaging exhibition. It covers four rooms, 68 paintings, and you'll learn a lot about what was happening in the world of art from 1860 to 1910. And that's at the Palace of the Legion of Honor.
Through August 3rd, and you can find information about tickets and hours at legionofhonor.famsf.org. Thanks very much, Peter.
Good to be here, and see you soon.
Indeed. A couple of mentions of some things coming up this weekend that former guests have talked about. The Sing for America concert is Sunday at 7 p.m. at the Palace of Fine Arts. 100-person chorus as a fundraising chorus, and exceptional soloists with a full orchestra singing Broadway, opera, and Americana, this year featuring Broadway star Marcus Lovett, among others. And one of those others is Metropolitan Opera star Marie Plett. Joined by local favorites as well, Sunday, March 30th at 7 p.m. Information at singforamerica.com. And the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, Dawn Harms, music director, has been a guest here on KALW. She's conducting the Bars Symphony on the 29th and 30th at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in works by Aaron Copland, Beethoven's Fidelio Overture, and Ravel's Introduction and Allegro for harp, flute, clarinet, and strings, featuring Dan Levitin at the harp. Also, Howard Hansen's massive, wonderful Symphony No. 2, The Romantic. Information for that Bars concert at bars-sf.org. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air. My thanks, as always, to Neil Swinkels for producing today's show and settling our lineup. You can hear this show, as well as any of the others in the past, at our website, kalw.org, to search for Open Air. And send us some show and guest ideas there as well. Thanks for listening. News from the BBC is next.